Okay, Hannah, you look very happy to try it. Do you want to go? Okay. All right. Come along.
We are the pupils of third class in Spa National School, and we have the best view of any class in Ireland. We look out at Tralee Bay and the Sleevmish Mountains every day, and it's an ever-changing picture. We decided to do our local heritage project on oyster fishing in Finnish, as we can see the fleet of fishing boats from our class.
You can do it again.
Oh, no.
Oh, God, no.
Are you okay?
Yeah.
Oh, that's horrendous. No, I'm not having that again.
It's like a slug in your mouth.
Tralee Bay, located in County Kerry on Ireland's Wild Atlantic Way, is one of the few self-seeding native wild Irish oyster fisheries found in Europe. The Tralee Bay oyster fishery is one of the largest self-reproducing oyster beds in Western Europe.
Mary O'Brien has a huge interest in teaching and telling everybody about the local area and its rich heritage.
My name is Mary O'Brien Brown. I'm from Finnish. I'm one of the oyster fishers, and we also operate Tralee Bay Experiences. Today here with the boys and girls from Spa National School, we're just watching the oyster flotilla in operations. At present we have a boat bringing up its catch here, as we can see, bringing up the fish boxes of oysters on a little trolley, and there's three of them there now coming towards us. So they're going to come in here now into the oyster fish factory, and they're going to be graded. Cold day. Look at these. These are from Spa National School. They won a prize last year about the oysters. How are you? Great to see you. See, look, they're heavy. Look how heavy they are, guys. Yeah, and there's more coming here now. And this fishery has been going on for generations in Finnish.
We just saw oysters being brought in by the boats that went to catch the oysters. And they're bringing them in so they can be cleaned and bagged.
And when we went out to see the oysters, there was 11 boats, but they don't. None of the boats go out in the summer to let oysters grow, or else they'd be taking too much and there'd be none left for the rest of the month.
Oh, when they're passing St. Brendan in the morning, they usually salute him to, like, keep them safe out in the boats.
There was a man, and he was been like oyster fishing since he was 11, and he was 79, and he was out fishing on his birthday.
How long have you been fishing for?
I've been fishing for around 60 years.
Really?
Yes. We were oyster fishing and all the other type of fishing, and I'm at it for a long, long time.
What's your favourite thing about oyster fishing?
Oh, it's a lovely, lovely job. It's a nice job. Myself and Marita, the two of us, we do all our fishing together. The weather is always very good to us. And we always make our lovely couple of pound out of it.
My name is Dennis O'Shea. I'm manager of Tralee Oyster Fishery Society. We're here in Finnet at the oyster store, where during the main fishing season for the flat oyster, which takes place in the autumn, all of the oysters are landed in centrally to the one store, where they are loaded by the fishermen into a hopper, which then takes them to a conveyor. On the conveyor, they are checked for size, for cleanliness. They then carry on from the conveyor into a bagging machine, where they are bagged off at fixed weights, placed on pallets, and then the pallets are loaded and exported. Most of the exports go to Holland, France and Spain, and in the latter few years, particularly into Spain, and they would be on the Spanish market within a week of leaving here.
These are native oysters. Compared to the gigas, is getting very popular, but these are the flat native oysters.
They are very heavy. They're a couple of kilos. Come on in now and we'll have a look at the grading system. So our European oyster now is just going into the grading machine. And Mario is going to turn it on in a second. And they're going to individually go through. Every oyster is hand-picked. And here now they're hand-graded also.
Right now I'm at the Tralee Oyster Fishing Society at Tralee Bay, and we are seeing all the oysters being like packaged, and we saw some diseased oysters and they let them die because they coral and other stuff sucks the life out of them and they become diseased and you don't want to eat them. So they just let them die. The oysters that don't have disease, they are packed into big sort of sacks and sent to shops around Ireland, and people enjoy them.
So now it's stopped because the bags are full, and they're going to empty out the bags and they'll start again then. You'd know by the shell. You'd know then if there's anything growing on it, anything fungal or any virus growing on it, it'll have a different colour. It won't look healthy. It'll have kind of maybe a yellowish tinge to it, and like a fungi kind of growing on it, like a fungi in a bread really. It'll be the same thing as to a shell. So each shell here that you're looking at is over 7.8 millimetres. So it's a good sized shell. And these shells, this fish, takes 4 years to grow. So what you're seeing was growing here in 2019, maybe. Go back a bit, 4 years, 2018, before COVID. So that these oysters are growing before COVID, you could say.
If you examine an oyster, the amount of rinks it has on it, that's the age that it is. It's just like a tree. The amount of rinks a tree has, that's the age that a tree is. And they can grow up to be at least 20 years old.
The oysters have to be 5 years or older to be fished or eaten.
Like, you can find them all over Phoenix, and sometimes they use this dredge to collect the oysters and they drag it along the bottom of the seafloor because oysters are normally stuck to rocks at the bottom of the seafloor.
They pack oysters in bags of 25 kg and they ship them off to France and Spain for the Easter and Christmas festivals.
Oysters start spawning in spring. They release eggs and sperm into the water.
Larvae grow a fish and settle on the seafloor in a rock or other oysters. After about 6 months, they are called spash.
We learned that they have a special ring, and if the oyster is too small and it goes through the ring, they put it back into the water because it isn't done growing. And when they're done with the oysters, most people throw them back into the water so that they can like help more oysters grow. A Japanese oyster is like one of the biggest oysters.
Mary O'Brien's husband has a license of oyster fishing.
Her husband has a boat and he goes fishing on it, oyster fishing. She brought us on a tour around Phoenix.
The boat that her husband went on was called Sundown, and he fills about 3 buckets of oysters a day. And the weirdest thing they found was pink nail polish, and it was all over the floor when we went in.
Mary Brown told us that Fina is one of the natural oyster growing areas in Europe. It's probably one of the best ones because there is so much nice oysters in there.
We got encouragement from Claudia from the museum about our local heritage in oyster fishing. We learned about the origin of the name Finnish and Finot, where the Fina of long ago are said to have lived, and there are up to 30 ring forts nearby. In 1973, our local restaurant even changed its name to Oyster Tavern after the natural beds in Spa Finnish area.
I like living in Phoenix because it's all wild and you never know what's going to happen. The weather's crazy, the waves are crazy occasionally, and it's just a really nice social kind of village.
Mary got her like licensey type of thing from her father, and she wants loads of fishermen to be in the future.
We learned the importance of all of us children and young people to continue to fish and sustain the local area.
What was once a thriving industry is now a danger of dying out. We are proud to be part of a coastal community, and we can play a role in protection of our maritime heritage.
Come September, we would like to find out what we could do to help protect our bay, our blue flag beaches, and especially the endangered sand dunes in Finnish.
Heritage Hunters was made in association with Kerry County Museum, funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.
When you think of Blenheville, the first thing you think of is the windmill.
The windmill is the largest working windmill in Ireland, and as the name suggests, the only power it needs is wind.
Blenheville Windmill is the only windmill along Ireland's Atlantic Way and the most westerly windmill in Europe.
The Blennerhassett family first arrives in Blenheville from England in 1586. It was Sir Roland Blennerhassett who developed Blenheville Port, built the iconic windmill, and gave Blenheville its name, changing it from Caer y Fawr, meaning seat of the big river. The British government introduced the Corn Laws, which granted bounties on the export of grain. This encouraged Irish farmers to move to tillage farming, as there was a shortage in the English markets. The grain trade flourished, and Blenheville prospered as a major port and trade centre.
The windmill reached a height of its activity in the years before 1815. A fall in the price of wheat after the end of the French Wars led to a decline in the milling, and the windmill stopped operating in the late 1820s. Orr McCown and Sons did renovate it in 1810 and install an auxiliary steam engine while their own mill at Edward Street, Tralee, was being constructed.
There's an ancient cornerstone in the windmill, and people can turn it to see how flour was made.
Blenheville Windmill is a very tall, five-storey windmill, more than 21 metres in height.
The wingspan is 18.3 metres, almost as tall as the windmill itself.
Hi, my name is Dunn, and I work at Blenheville Windmill.
How fast can the sails go?
It's around 12 revolutions per minute, so that's 10 seconds for your sails to hit the top to go around again. If it goes faster than that, it can actually go on fire. And because the cap is actually not connected to the top, it can get really, really fast and kind of fly off. So it is actually quite dangerous. So we have to keep an eye on the speed, so 12 revolutions per minute. So I'd always have to keep an eye on the wind and direction because of that reason.
What do you do when there is a storm?
So when there's a storm, I actually have to direct the sails directly into the storm. I'd have to just literally turn the whole cap into the direction of where the wind is coming from and tie it in an X.
The windmill at Blenheville is supposed to be the oldest building for miles around the village. When it was first made, the owner's wife, Lady Blenheville, went up on the balcony of it.
Rowland's wife, Millicent, was killed in 1801 when she visited the newly opened windmill, looked out of a window and was struck by a sail.
Millicent!
Some say she was decapitated.
She's supposed to be up there to the present day.
Is the ghost of Millicent Blenheville haunting the windmill? Was she really decapitated?
Her head is reported to come off, but I think it's kind of more of a gory story. It's more exaggerated over time. She was supposed to be hit there, and what happened is she walked out and got her head hit by the sails and died. We also had ghost hunters inside in the windmill, so I've had people inside her a lot and looking for orbs, and they did say they found an orb inside her, and it is supposed to be small but haunted, but it's a good ghost, as they say.
How many steps are up to the top of the windmill?
There's 52 steps up to the top of the windmill, so there's one step for every week of the year. It's quite a big windmill. It's actually the largest working windmill in Ireland.
What's the fun fact not many people know about the windmill?
Whenever Kerry get to an All-Ireland final, we always put flags on top of it, the Kerry flags. And when it turns, it's actually lovely to see the Kerry flags on top of it. Something that's pretty cool that a lot of people don't know about is actually one of the most dangerous things in a windmill is actually dust explosion. So your flour is actually flammable. So when it's filtered all over the air, what you have is something that can go on fire and oxygen around it. So if you lit a match to it, the whole place could go up on fire.
Why do you like being a tour guide at the windmill?
That's a very good question, Ruby. I love being a tour guide at the windmill because you can show people around the place and show people how a windmill works. A lot of people don't, they come here to see because it's beautiful and stuff like that, but you can really show them how it works. And renewable energy is the way we're going right now. So the windmill will turn and it'll make flour and stuff like that, but if you even have put a domino on it, it would actually make electricity to light a light bulb. So, you know, it is the way we're moving forward. So a lot of people are interested to see how these work and how we would have done before, just in case we'll ever have to do that again. Also, you get to meet lovely characters, and it's always a bit of fun. We'd go away, we'd make a bit of flour together, we'd grind it, and I'd show you the difference between white and brown flour, and have a bit of fun as well, because I'm doing the tour all the time. If I'm doing it all the time, it's like teaching the same class of maths every day. You'd be bored after about 2 weeks, right? So to make it exciting, I get to learn more about you. You learn a bit about me, and we learn about the windmill, and meeting new people and showing how it works is really cool as well. So, yeah. That's one of my favourite things about working there, is actually showing people around the place.
We spoke to our parents and grandparents to see if they had stories about the windmill.
It was around 1980 when Sheemsa were doing a play on Don Quixote. They went out to the windmill to take photos for it because he had something where he fought windmills.
You do not frighten me!
And they didn't have any horses for them, so my granddad had a horse farm in Ballard. So my granddad, William O'Connor, they got him to dress up as Don Quixote and tap on the horse to take the photo. They stuck a beard on him and everything. They told him to remain serious, but there was no way he could, so the photo ended up with him laughing his head off. My parents had their first kiss at the windmill.
My dad has a book that he was given from his mum, and it's really old. It was published in 1889. And it's got a bunch of facts about the windmill, diagrams and pictures of it. As part of a school project, our teacher asked us to create our own individual windmills using recycled items, reused items and items from the environment.
We used motors to make a propeller turn and coded it to make it spin for periods of time.
I went to a friend's workshop. He cut out bunches of wood and I glued them all together and painted them and used some nuts and bolts to make a propeller on it to make it move around.
I recycled old pieces of wood. I cut out sheets of metal and put them all together to make a model of a windmill.
I made my project out of bits of stones and shells from the area. I collected these on Cockleshell to make the windmill, and then I used the little stones to create the bricks on the bridge.
Me and my dad created a model windmill completely out of recycled materials. The sails is made out of plastic spoons and a bottle cap. The base is made out of plasterboard, and the tower and nacelle is like where you store all the components, are made out of old PVC pipe. Then inside, there's an old wiring kit, an old toy wiring kit, an old switch that we actually got from a Nerf gun, an old electric Nerf gun, and of course, the little hinge to open and close the nacelle was made out of Lego. Oh yes, and the little man inside, his name is Old Man Marvin. He's like the Sir Rowling of it. He's also made out of Lego, and he is the only reason this thing hasn't fallen to bits, because he's the little repairs man.
I made my windmill out of Kinects. My brother got them for Christmas, so he helped me make a little windmill, and it had the little propellers, and they could spin if you touched them. 1842, 1847 and 1855, the Kerry Evening Post newspaper advertised the letting of the windmill. In 1856, it was described as the ruins of a windmill in a local newspaper. The Blenerville windmill was for sale again in 1882 and was valued at £20. The sails of the windmill had disappeared in the heavy gales of 1890. The windmill was used as a storehouse and a place for cutting sleepers during the construction of the Tralee Dingle Railway in 1891.
The cap of the windmill, which had survived strong gales for over 100 years, was finally dislodged during the Great Wind in 1910. The building itself slowly deteriorated over the next 70 years, leaving a bare shell on the landscape.
Like most windmills in Ireland, Blenerville Mill was disused by 1890 and fell in disrepair.
Luckily, in 1981, it was purchased by Tralee District Council and restored to full working order